Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour, bringing you the latest on the second day of Benedict XVI's pastoral journey to the United Kingdom, which culminates in Birmingham on Sunday with the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman, which began on Thursday, 16th of September, with an encounter with Queen Elizabeth at her official Scottish residence of Holyrood House, originally built as a monastery in the 12th century, a day during which the Pope travelled to Glasgow in the afternoon, precisely to preside over an open-air mass in Bellahouston Park, where the Holy Father followed in the footsteps of his predecessor to the See of Peter, John Paul II. It was 1982. So the Pope spent only 10 hours on Scottish soil, but the people north of the border from all different churches and backgrounds were determined this was a day they would never forget.
It's the ancient language of your country. Si agas benach jevif ul, chia vishimelech adef, agas gam benach if chia alape. God's peace and blessing to you all. God surround you. And may God bless the people of Scotland.
Arriving on the day the local church celebrates its evangeliser, St. Ninian, his was a busy schedule, at the end of which he flew down to London in time for his first appointment on Friday morning, which included a visit to St. Mary's University College in Twickenham. Philippa Hitchin is travelling with the Pope and filed this report.
Education has been at the heart of the Church's mission here in England for centuries. The great medieval universities still stand as an eloquent witness to that. And in those days, there were also many small, informal schools held in parishes, churches, cathedrals and monasteries around the country, offering basic reading skills alongside knowledge of the Psalms, the Ten Commandments and the daily liturgies. Since the restoration of the Catholic hierarchy here in 1850, education has also been one of the main focuses of the Church's action as it struggled to rebuild a vibrant community following the devastation and destruction of the Reformation period. St. Mary's College, where the Pope met with thousands of children from Catholic schools all over England and Wales on Friday, dates back to that same period in the mid-19th century, when education of children was deemed more essential for that task than even the building of new churches or cathedrals. The college moved to its current location in the 1920s, focused back then on training teachers for Catholic schools. More recently, it's been raised to university status and also boasts some of the finest sports training facilities in the country. No surprise, then, that Pope Benedict chose this occasion to inaugurate a new sports foundation dedicated to the memory of his sporting predecessor, Pope John Paul II.
In view of London's forthcoming Olympic Games, it has been a pleasure to inaugurate the Sports Foundation, named in honor of Pope John Paul II. And I pray that all who come here will give glory to God through their sporting activities, as well as bring enjoyment to themselves and to others.
It was a relaxed and joyful encounter of the Pope with the excited kids and their teachers. Gathered in smart school uniforms alongside a bunch of TV stars and Olympic athletes. And the Pope himself seemed relaxed and at home with these children of many different nationalities and religious backgrounds, talking to them in a down-to-earth way about the search for happiness and fulfillment in their lives.
Young people are often encouraged to model themselves on figures from the world of sport or entertainment. My question for you is this. What are the qualities you see in others that you would most like to have yourselves? What kind of person would you really like to be?
True happiness, the Pope said, can only be found when we become friends with God, allowing Him into our lives to guide us in everything we do. While the world needs great scientists and economists, historians and philosophers, he said the most important thing a school can provide is a rounded education that helps children understand the bigger picture of their place in God's great creation. Respect and friendship for members of other religious faiths is also an essential value that must be taught in Catholic schools, the Pope said, echoing the theme he developed later that morning with leaders of the many other faith groups with a sizable presence in this country today.
As followers of different religious traditions working together for the good of the community at large, we attach great importance to this side-by-side dimension of our cooperation, which complements the face-to-face aspect of our continuing dialogue.
The Pope also had words of encouragement for the many religious men and women, past and present, who've pioneered the teaching ministry in these lands and around the world, recalling his own childhood when he was taught by sisters of the order founded by the Venerable Mary Ward.
I myself, as a young boy, was taught by the English ladies, and I owe them a deep debt of gratitude.
Pope Benedict urged all involved in this vital work to follow, above all else, the faithful, loving witness of Christ, the supreme teacher. In the UK, with Pope Benedict, I'm Philippa Hitchin.
I want a school where I can study.
I want the right to have my home.
I want everyone to join hands.
Can we count on you?
I want young people to live in hope.
I want happiness that is born from peace.
I want my steps to mark this earth.
I want a different world.
Can we count on you?
The delightful voices of young people there at this big assembly, as it was dubbed. Earlier, Philippa had also spoken to the vice chair of the board of St Mary's and director of the Catholic Education Service for England and Wales. Her name, Una Stannard. Stay tuned.
You're there in St Mary's, which is in fact one of the oldest training colleges, isn't it, in the United Kingdom, Catholic training colleges to promote Catholic education. Tell us a little bit about the history of the college.
Well, St Mary's now University College goes back a very long way. It's had an existence on a prior site to Twickenham as well. And you're absolutely right, it's been at the forefront of providing teachers for Catholic schools. But it's evolved a lot since then too. It began as an all-male college, and you're right, it began as a teacher training college. It now has over 4,000 full-time equivalent students. Many are studying for teaching or postgraduate qualifications related to education, but many more are studying in other areas, for instance law, studying things related to sports science and business, very, very prominent and successful school of theology. So it's got a very broad base, and as I say, it's now a university college awarding its own degrees. So we're very proud of it within the Catholic community, and it indeed is serving the wider community, the church and beyond.
Let's take a little bit of a broader view for a moment and look at the whole role of Catholic education in England and Wales there. It's always been a priority, really, for the church, hasn't it?
Yes, without question. Following the restoration of the hierarchy in England and Wales, the bishops made it a clear, avowed priority to give prominence to Catholic education even before the building of churches. And that's put education, Catholic education, at the heart of the church's mission, and we have a very important and celebrated partnership between parish, home and school. So we now have in England and Wales over 2,300 Catholic schools which are in partnership with government in terms of how our schools are funded. We have over 800,000 pupils in our schools, and we form over 10% of the country's school places. So we're a very central provider, and we're in a statutory partnership with government, whilst ensuring through our negotiations legally and all our policy discussions with government that we've retained the rights and responsibilities to ensure that as a church, the education in our Catholic schools is authentically Catholic.
And our thanks there go to Una Stannard, the director of the Catholic Education Service for England and Wales and the vice chair of the board of St Mary's University College in Twickenham. And thanks also to Philippa. Later on Friday in the afternoon, Benedict XVI made an afternoon courtesy visit to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, at Lambeth Palace, delivered an address to civil society at Westminster Hall, and ended the day on a more spiritual note with a celebration of evening prayer together with the Archbishop of Canterbury at Westminster Abbey. You can hear all about those meetings at this same time tomorrow, when Philippa Hitchin will be tracing the Holy Father's steps during this packed afternoon. Meanwhile, I thought I'd like you to join me as I bring a little bit of background on the Abbey itself with Monsignor Philip Whitmore. Westminster Abbey was founded by a king known as Edward the Confessor, so it was a royal church from the very beginning. And if you walk in, it's that pageant of English history that strikes you with its wealth of monuments and artwork. It's steeped in more than 1,000 years of history. So the beginnings of Westminster Abbey were Catholic, weren't they?
Well, yes, if you go back to the 11th century, that was before the divisions of the Reformation. So, yes, very much in communion with Rome. And the Abbey Church was dedicated to St. Peter, and it's a sign, if you like, of the particular connection, certainly at that time, between the church in London and the church of Rome, that the cathedral was St. Paul's and the Abbey Church in Westminster was dedicated to St. Peter. So you had St. Peter and St. Paul, two great founding saints of Rome.
And there's still a Catholic abbot today.
Well, there is a connection, in as much as one of the very last monks to have been a monk of Westminster before the abbey was finally suppressed in the 16th century, went into exile, and as a very old man was part of the community that eventually became Ampleforth Abbey. So, yes, there is that historical connection between Ampleforth and Westminster, but it goes through, obviously, the exile and very difficult times.
Ampleforth is a Benedictine abbey, so the Benedictine legacy lives on in Westminster Abbey in a way, no?
Yes, in fact, a great many of the medieval English cathedrals were monastic foundations. Canterbury was a monastic foundation, and Durham, and you can see the cloister where the monks lived, and the liturgy, the beautiful liturgy that is so characteristic of English cathedrals, goes back to the days when so many of them were monastic foundations. And suddenly Westminster Abbey was a Benedictine monastic foundation, and that gave it its particular tradition, the particular flavour of the solemn and formal liturgy.
So it's felt in daily prayer and in hospitality, of course, because the Benedictines have this charism of hospitality, don't they?
They do, yes, yes, that's right.
You've been to Westminster Abbey like I have possibly many times. Is there something you'd particularly like to talk about?
Well, I suppose most of my visits to the Abbey took place during the 6 years when I was working just down the road at Westminster Cathedral, and they were a very obvious ecumenical partner for us on the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, for example, and also on the Feast of St. Edward, because you mentioned the king who founded the Abbey. His shrine is actually there in Westminster Abbey, so we venerate that as the shrine of one of our national saints. And the Feast of St. Edward was an occasion when the clergy of the Abbey, the Dean and Chapter, used to invite us from Westminster Cathedral to go and celebrate an ecumenical evening prayer with them, and we would venerate the shrine of St. Edward in the course of that evening. So there are many such ecumenical events that I recall being involved with, and some musical events too, because both Westminster Abbey and Westminster Cathedral have very fine professional choirs. And there was a festival that took place around the time of St. Cecilia, the Feast of St. Cecilia, when the three choirs of St. Paul's Cathedral, Westminster Abbey and Westminster Cathedral would come together, and we would rotate from one church to the other, but the choirs would come together, and it was a really amazing sound when you got the three of them together there. So it was a great privilege to be part of that.
What's the music like? I know that a lot of the hymns we sing in church are Anglican hymns, no?
Quite a few of them are, yes, and that's one of the great riches that we've had since the development of the ecumenical movement, that those are things we can very usefully share, and they sing quite a lot of Catholic music as well. Probably wouldn't have happened so much in the past, but this is something that we can and do share.
Catholic music, which goes back to, for example, Gregorian chant or not?
I was thinking more of Renaissance motets and perhaps Latin motets, which they would certainly sing during
evensong. So not going back so far?
Probably not going back so far, at least not very often.
There are a lot of kings and queens there, buried there, but there are also famous literary characters, no?
Yes, there's Poets' Corner, all sorts of distinguished people. George Frederick Handel is buried there, has a great monument, and Henry Purcell. Yes, indeed.
So musicians as well as literary figures. So it's not just Poets' Corner, it should be Musicians' Corner as well, no?
Oh, well, lots of people have their corners. There was a very moving occasion when Cardinal Hume, of course, himself a Benedictine, when he was installed as Archbishop of Westminster, he being a Benedictine, he wanted to go down and have an ecumenical service of evening prayer with to which a great many monks were invited. And he prayed there, and he spoke of the chapel where Queen Mary Tudor and Queen Elizabeth I are buried side by side, two sisters who were divided in terms of the church. They belonged to the church they represented, and yet there they are buried together. And he hoped and prayed, indeed, that that might be a sign of future reconciliation between the churches. And this was a very important element of his first day as Archbishop of Westminster. He wanted to make that very public statement in the Abbey.
And what our thanks there go to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, currently in England with the Pope. I'd like you to join me as I step back in time for a very English story, focusing on relations between Rome and Canterbury. I'd like to take you with me on a historical journey back in time. I'm about to do this by sharing with you some exclusive sound from our archives here at Vatican Radio. My story begins on the 1st of October 1950 with an historical radio message Pius XII sent through the microphones of Vatican Radio, unusually to English Catholics gathered in Wembley Stadium. The radio message made history because it marked a century and a half since the restoration of the Catholic hierarchy of England and Wales, a hierarchy restored in 1850 by Pius IX with the apostolic letter Universalis Ecclesiae. Just think, until then there had been no Catholic bishops in England since the reign of Mary Tudor. On that occasion, Pius XII spoke beautifully, expressing himself in what seems to us today, perhaps, a somewhat archaic English. Just listen.
Our predecessor, Pius IX, of a blessed memory, decided the time had come for the Catholic Church in England to resume its proper place in the normal constitution of the Church. And by the apostolic letter Universalis Ecclesiae, he re-established in England and Wales the hierarchy of a bishop's ordinary, each to rule the Catholics in his own diocese.
Pius XII, who, by the way, was the first pope to make use of radio at an international scale, referred to that ancient hierarchy established long before Catholics in England and Wales were persecuted and martyred for their faith.
Of Augustine and Thomas and Edmund, of Wilfrid, of York and the Hugh of Lincoln, then it was God raised up that generation of amazing heroes trained in the school of a crucified leader to fear neither rack nor rope, who came to sustain the flickering light of a faith that would not die.
And Pius XII's words became particularly poignant when he spoke of the bonds being severed.
When those bonds were severed, and by a mysterious providence of heaven, the blackness of a night settled down on the church, then it was God raised up that generation of amazing heroes
Heroes that, hidden away in the heart of Rome, are still remembered in a place they may surely have visited before becoming Pope.
With that veneration and all of the memories, one prays before the painting of the King of Martyrs in the venerable English College Chapel, while before the mind's eye there pass a Sherwin, a Campion, a Saddle, and a host of others, cleric and lay. They died, and the faith in England lived on.
Martyrs, 40 of whom were canonized by Paul VI in 1970. In a ceremony which, in an unprecedented gesture, representatives of the Anglican Church were invited to attend, the Pope recognized the opportunity to put into practice the teachings of the Second Vatican Council, as he himself highlighted on that occasion. For the future reunion of the separated members of the one mystical body of Christ, in the knowledge that we have in heaven such allies and representatives of the cause of union and peace among all Christians. Ecumenical relations, in fact, had become so relaxed in the aftermath of the council that the very next year Anglican students even lived in this very college. Where young English Catholics were once obliged to study for the priesthood, simply because they could not do so at home for fear of persecution, and where once upon a time the community used to sing the Te Deum each time they heard from England of another martyrdom of one of their former students. That was in the 16th century, when to profess being a Catholic, or worse still, a priest, meant being hung, drawn, and quartered. But why don't you join me on a little visit there with historian Stella Fletcher, who in her own manner describes some harrowing paintings of the fate of the martyrs.
We're now in the gallery of the English College. Down below is the chapel, but we're now upstairs and we're surrounded by the most gruesome looking paintings. What have we got there? There's somebody being burnt and then somebody hanging above them. Oh, there, that one's having his innards taken out. Oh, he's about to be beheaded. It's all pretty gruesome. Now, what's the point of all this? These were painted in the 16th century and they depict the fate awaiting the young Englishmen who are here in Rome training to be Catholic priests, and they're going to be sent back to the England of Elizabeth I. And the message of these paintings is, this is what you're going back to. You are going to be martyred. Basically, it's a very, very tense atmosphere.
The English College is called venerable to this day, among other reasons, because the relics of the martyrs are still venerated there on the 1st of December each year, when the Te Deum is still sung. But getting back to our Vatican Radio sound archive, I searched high and low for traces of the first meeting between Rome and Canterbury since 1397. And although I discovered it was on the 2nd of December 1960, I did not find any sound of the event in our archives. What I did discover, however, was that it was John the 23rd who set the ball rolling when he sent the Archbishop of Canterbury the message, "Two souls can meet in prayer, though distance divides." A message the Archbishop of Canterbury of the time, Dr. Geoffrey Fisher, readily responded to by coming to Rome, commenting after the hour-long encounter, "Your Holiness, we are making history." And reflecting later on the warmth of this historic moment, "I did not have to create an atmosphere of friendship. I walked straight into it." However, this visit was certainly not as official as the one which would follow. It was, as Peter Nichols of The Times then wrote, treated like a guilty secret. A whole different scenario then to the meeting between Rome and Canterbury only 6 years later. That's 40 years ago. The Pope then was Paul VI and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Michael Ramsay. It took place in 1966 in the Sistine Chapel, and the Roman pontiff's words were in Latin.
Lumine Christia fulgente, singulare advertimus momentum muius congressionis, qua Ecclesia Cattolica Romana, atque Ecclesia Anglicana et Ecclesiae Communionis Anglicane, inter se quasi occurrunt.
While Archbishop Michael Ramsay spoke in English.
I have come with the longing in my heart, which I know to be in your heart also, that we may, by our meeting together, help in the fulfillment of the prayer of our divine Lord, that all his disciples may come to unity in the truth. So may the song of the angels be echoed in the wills and actions of men. Gloria in excelsis Deo et in terra pax.
Gloria, gloria, gloria in excelsis Deo et in terra pax. Pax, pax opinibus.
And that evening, the Archbishop of Canterbury stayed as the Pope's guest at the Venerable English College. As Monsignor Adrian Toffolo, rector of the English College in the late 1990s, mentioned, the Sistine Chapel meeting had a follow-up the very next day. Paul VI and the Archbishop of Canterbury both went to the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls for a joint prayer meeting to sign the Common Declaration, launching thereby the serious dialogue founded on the Gospels and on the ancient common traditions, which would soon become known as Archic. Let's listen.
His Holiness the Pope and His Grace the Archbishop of Canterbury are indeed aware that serious obstacles stand in the way of a restoration of complete communion of faith and sacramental life. Nevertheless, they are of one mind in their determination to promote responsible contacts between their communions in all those spheres of church life where collaboration is likely to lead to a greater understanding and a deeper charity, and to strive in common to find solutions for all the great problems that face those who believe in Christ in the world of today.
It was here as the notes of Ubi Caritas resounded throughout the great basilica.
Ubi Caritas et amor Deo sibi.
That in a momentous gesture, Paul VI took off his episcopal ring, placing it on the forefinger of His Grace Michael Ramsay, thereby symbolically sealing the hopes of future understanding between Canterbury and Rome. This same ring has since been passed down. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget to check out our website for the papal events in real time. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Laudetur Jesus Christus.